This episode is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 24 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Which, honestly, is exactly what you need for this kind of material.
Oh, absolutely. So picture this. You're sitting at your desk on a random Tuesday, right?
Just a totally normal day.
Right. And suddenly, the door opens, and a team of federal regulators just walks right in. They ask for your emails. They ask for your ledger. They ask why one of your brokers guaranteed a client against a loss.
Which is terrifying.
Yeah. And if you don't have the exact right answers documented in the exact right way, you are not just looking at a fine. You could be looking at the 5-20-25 rule.
Right. Which is an incredibly sobering reality.
Yeah.
Because if you violate the Exchange Act of 1934, we are talking about a maximum $5 million individual fine, plus 20 years in federal prison. And a $25 million fine for your firm.
20 years. I mean, that is the kind of high-stakes reality we are dealing with today. Welcome to this deep dive. If you are sitting for the Series 24 exam, you are currently staring at just a mountain of material.
So massive.
You've got, you know, numbers, rules, timelines, exceptions to the exceptions. I completely understand how overwhelming this looks.
It is the absolute definition of regulatory muddy waters. Just incredibly dense.
Exactly. But our goal for this deep dive is not just rote memorization. Because if you just flip flashcards, I mean, the exam writers are going to eat you alive with trick questions.
Yeah, they love testing the weird edge cases.
So today, we are going to deeply learn, retain, and most importantly, apply the why behind every single one of these rules. We want you to completely crush the Series 24.
And to make these, you know, incredibly dense concepts actually stick in your brain, we are not going to just read you a textbook.
Please, no.
Right. Instead, we are going to build a completely functional yet highly problematic fictional broker-dealer from the ground up.
I am so excited for this. So to populate this purely hypothetical firm, I want to introduce you to our cast of characters. You're going to spend a lot of time with them today. First, we have Desperate Dave.
Oh, Dave.
Yeah, Dave is a registered rep who is constantly looking for a shortcut. Like, if there is a razor's edge of a FINRA violation, Dave is skating right on it.
And then we have Forgetful Fred. Fred is a well-meaning, incredibly friendly broker, but he is just fundamentally disorganized.
Yeah.
He couldn't keep a timeline or a record retention schedule straight if his life depended on it.
And finally, we have Careful Clara. So Clara is the firm's brilliant, eternally stressed chief compliance officer.
The CCO.
Right, the CCO. She's a registered principal, and honestly, her entire full-time job seems to be cleaning up the massive messes that Dave and Fred leave behind.
She definitely has her work cut out for her.
Yeah.
Because the logical flow of our deep dive today basically tracks the full life cycle of her firm. First, Clara has to establish the rules of our house. That's the written supervisory procedure.
Okay, step one.
Then next, we figure out how to document those rules, which is books and records. Then we have to actually fund the house, which brings us to financial responsibility.
Because we need cash to keep the lights on.
Mm.
And once we have that cash, we need to figure out what Dave and Fred are actually allowed to sell to our clients. That's product and service supervision.
Exactly. And after they sell the products, we have to figure out how they get paid legally. That's compensation practices.
And finally, because, well, we hired Dave and Fred, we are going to watch them break all those rules, which leads us to conduct and ultimately facing the music with disciplinary actions.
That's full journey.
It really is. Okay, let's build the foundation. Let's start with the rules of the house. We are talking about written supervisory procedures, or WSPs. So I'm looking at the core mandate here, and it says a member firm must establish, maintain, and enforce a supervisory system.
Notice the emphasis on that last word, enforce.
Like actually doing it.
Exactly. Having a beautiful leather-bound compliance manual sitting on a shelf does nothing.
Yeah.
If nobody follows it, you don't actually have a supervisory system in the eyes of FINRA.
It's exactly like a gym membership. Like, just holding the plastic key tag doesn't make you physically fit. You have to actually enforce your routine. You have to go to the gym and lift the weights. Perfect WSPs on paper fail entirely if they are never tested in reality.
That is a phenomenal analogy. So to actually, you know, lift the weights, the regulators require your supervisory system to rest on 7 specific pillars. You need the written procedures themselves. You have to designate registered principals for every single line of business.
Yeah.
And you must classify every single office location.
Wait, let me pause you there. Classify every office. What does that actually mean for Clara's firm?
It means she has to look at every physical location and assign it a regulatory label. You have your OSJ, the Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction. That's your headquarters or like a major regional hub.
Yeah.
Then you have supervising branches, non-supervising branches, and non-branch locations, like a residential supervisory location or an RSL if someone is just working from their home.
Got it. What are the other pillars?
So beyond classifying the offices, you need an on-site principal at every OSJ in every branch. You have to assign every registered person, like Dave and Fred, to a specific supervisor. You must make reasonable efforts to ensure those supervisors are qualified. And finally, you have to hold an annual compliance meeting for everyone.
Okay, that sounds incredibly rigid, but I'm reading a phrase here, the reasonable review standard. It says the SEC and FINAMAR require scaling. How can these rules be scaled if they are so strict?
Because there is no one-size-fits-all compliance manual. Regulators expect your WSPs to reflect your actual specific business risk.
Oh, I see.
Right, so a boutique firm with 5 employees that only sells plain vanilla mutual funds should not have the same massive compliance infrastructure as, you know, a 5,000-person wirehouse that trades complex leveraged derivatives. You scale your procedures to your size, your structure, and the complexity of your products.
That makes total sense. I mean, why would Clara write a 200-page procedure on trading commodity futures if her firm doesn't even sell them?
A quick side note on that. I was looking at my notes, and commodity futures aren't even regulated by the SEC, right? They're regulated by the CFTC.
Correct. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Futures are contracts for future delivery, not capital-raising securities like stocks or bonds, which is why they fall under a completely different regulatory body. So Clara wouldn't need SEC or FINRA procedures for them anyway. All right, let's talk about the inspection cadence for these different office types. I want to put our characters into a scenario here. Let's say Clara's main office is an OSJ. She handles compliance there, but she has absolutely zero customer foot traffic. Nobody walks in off the street. However, from her desk, she remotely supervises forgetful Fred.
This won't end well.
Never does. So Fred operates out of a tiny, one-man, non-branch location out in the suburbs. Okay, I am talking directly to you, the listener. Think about this. If Clara has zero foot traffic, but she is officially supervising Fred's remote location, how often does Clara's branch need to be inspected? Take a second.
It's a tricky one.
The answer is annually. Why? Because ANY branch that supervises another location automatically gets bumped to an annual inspection requirement, completely regardless of how much foot traffic it gets.
Spot on. Supervisory responsibilities trigger the highest level of scrutiny. So Fred's tiny non-branch location out in the suburbs, that only needs to be inspected at least once every 3 years.
Wow. Okay.
But Clara's gets inspected every year. And here is a critical mechanical detail. A firm cannot do self-inspections.
Wait, so Clara is the CCO. Are you saying she can't inspect her own OSJ?
Exactly. The person conducting the inspection cannot report to or hold responsibility at the location they're inspecting. It removes the conflict of interest. She would need another qualified principal from a different location or an independent consultant to actually inspect her office.
Okay, that leads me to the certification process. How does a firm prove to the regulators that they're actually going to the gym and lifting the weights?
They use a three-layered certification stack. First, there is the internal supervisory controls report. This is a detailed document sent to senior management testing the system. And if your firm does $200 million or more in gross revenue gross, not net helm, that report requires enhanced, more rigorous controls.
That's layer one. What's layer two?
Layer two is the CEO certification. The chief executive officer must annually certify that the firm has these processes in place.
I have to push back on this. Why on earth does the CEO have to sign it?
I know, it seems weird.
Right. I mean, Clara is the chief compliance officer. She wrote the manual. She's the one inspecting the branches. She understands the nuances of the regulations. The CEO is busy looking at revenue and strategy. Why can't Clara just sign the certification?
This gets to the very heart of regulatory philosophy. The regulators explicitly forbid delegating this signature to the CCO.
Yeah.
Because they want ultimate, terrifying accountability resting at the very top of the corporate food chain. The CEO must have skin in the game.
Ah, so they can't play dumb.
Exactly. The rule does require that the CEO and the CCO meet at least once in the preceding 12 months to thoroughly discuss the system. Clara has to brief the CEO. But the CEO has to put their pen to the paper. If the firm blows up in a massive scandal, the CEO cannot point their finger at the compliance department and say, I had no idea.
That is brilliant. Forced accountability. Okay, what is the third layer of the stack?
The business continuity plan, or BCP. This is your disaster recovery roadmap. If there's a hurricane, a cyber attack, or a pandemic, how does the firm keep running? Got it. Okay, listener, if you are prepping for the exam, you need to circle, highlight, and underline this next part in your brain. These are the classic exam traps for the rules of the house.
Right. This is where the exam tries to get you. The first major trap is confusing the 45-day rule with the annual certification. As we said, the CEO certifies the system annually on a rolling anniversary date. However, the report detailing this supervisory system must be submitted to the firm's board of directors or audit committee within 45 days of that CEO certification.
So the certification is once a year, but the board report is a 45-day trailing deadline attached to it. Do not mix those up. Trap number two is buried in the business continuity plan.
Right. FINR mandates that a BCP contain 10 specific elements, but there is one element that is absolute life or death. If a firm's BCP omits customers' prompt access to their funds and securities, it is presumptively non-compliant. It is not an optional suggestion. If a disaster hits, your customers must be able to get their cash and their stock, which makes perfect sense. And the third trap involves the FINRA manual itself. I was looking at this rule. A firm must provide customers with access to the FINRA manual. Does Claire seriously have to print out a 10,000-page physical binder and leave it sitting on the coffee table in the lobby?
Absolutely not. And that's exactly what the test will try to trick you into believing. An electronic hyperlink to finra.org on the firm's website completely satisfies the access requirement.
Oh, thank goodness. Okay, so Clara has the rules in place. The CEO has signed off. The disaster plans are filed. But as my old accounting professor used to say, if it isn't documented, it never happened, which flows perfectly into section two, keeping the receipts, otherwise known as books and records.
The rules for books and records are fascinating because they operate under a massive umbrella. FINRA ties its rules directly to the SEC's record-keeping infrastructure under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934.
Wait, why does that matter for Dave and Fred?
Because it allows FINRA to double-dip on violations.
Oof.
Yeah. Let's say Fred saves a required client record, but he saves it in the wrong electronic format. He violated the SEC rule. But because of the umbrella, that format failure automatically becomes a standalone FINRA offense as well. They can hit the firm twice for one mistake.
Ouch. All right, let's talk about the retention timelines. This is where everyone's eyes sort of glaze over because it's just a wall of numbers. So to wake everybody up, we are going to use a pattern interrupt. I want you to imagine we are sitting in the bleachers at a baseball game. We are going to execute the 6-4-3 ledger play.
I love this one.
All right, bottom of the ninth, pitches on the way ground ball right up the middle to the ledger. We've got the flagship records coming in. Customer account info is scooped up by the shortstop. That is a 6-year retention. Shortstop flips the written customer complaints to second base. That's 4 years. And second base fires the negotiable instrument authorizations over to first 3 years. It is a beautiful 6-4-3 double play.
That was intense.
Did that stick, listener? 6-4-3. Customer account info is 6 years. Written complaints are 4 years. Authorizations are 3 years. But why? Why are these numbers different?
That is the crucial why you need to understand. Let's look at the shortstop customer account information. Why 6 years? Because this is the foundational KYC data, know your customer.
Right.
If a client sues the firm half a decade later, claiming they were put into an unsuitable investment, the firm needs that original account opening document to prove what the client's risk tolerance was. 6 years gives a long runway for legal disputes to surface.
Okay, so what about the throw to second base? Why are written customer complaints only kept for 4 years?
Because that timeline is synced directly with FINRA's standard examination cycles. FINRA typically audits firms on a cycle ranging from 1 to 4 years. They want to ensure that every time an examiner walks through the door, a complete historical log of all complaints since the last visit is sitting right there in the file.
That is so much easier to remember when you know the logic. And the final throw to first base, the 3-year bucket, that's just the SEC's standard default floor for most other communications and authorizations, right?
Exactly. Now let's directly compare two concepts that constantly confuse test takers, record making versus record retention.
Walk me through the difference.
Record making governs what you actually have to create in the first place. For example, the rules say every account record needs dual sign-off from the registered rep and a principal. That is making the record.
Right.
Record retention governs how long and in what format you keep that piece of paper once it exists.
Speaking of format, let's dive into electronic storage. Clara can't just have Fred save all his client files onto a random USB thumb drive he bought at a gas station, right?
Definitely not. The SEC requires electronic storage to be in WORM format or an acceptable audit trail alternative.
WORM. Write once, read many.
Correct. It means that once a record is saved to the storage medium, it fundamentally cannot be altered, overwritten, or erased by anyone, not even Clara. It is burned in. And if the firm uses a third-party cloud storage vendor to host these worm records, the firm must secure independent access.
Meaning Clara has to have the keys to the kingdom.
Yes. She must be able to pull those records directly from the cloud without needing to call the vendor for permission or assistance. The regulators don't want a vendor holding records hostage during a financial dispute.
All right, let's put Forgetful Fred into a scenario. Fred's tiny one-man branch just isn't generating enough commissions. The firm is bleeding money keeping his lights on, so Clara and the CEO decide to shut his location down and close out his specific broker-dealer registration.
Probably a smart business move.
Definitely. They need to file Form BDW, the broker-dealer withdrawal form. So Fred, trying to be helpful for once, fills out the form. He tosses it in the outgoing mailbox, figuring he will just find some other firm to hold his boxes of old client records sometime next month.
And this is the moment. Careful Clara sprints down the hallway screaming and physically tackles Fred before the mail carrier arrives.
Why the dramatic tackle?
Because on Form BDW, you are legally required to designate an eligible custodian who agrees to hold the firm's records after the withdrawal is complete. That custodian has to be someone who was an associated person of the firm at the time of filing, or another active FANARA member firm. But the critical mechanic is that custodian consent must be affirmative, written, and informed before you file the form.
You cannot just file the paperwork first and go shopping for a signature later.
Never. And here's a massive point to remember. Filing Form BDW does not magically end the retention periods. Withdrawal is merely a change of custody event. It is not a document destruction event. Those 6:43 clocks keep ticking exactly as they were.
Clara saves the day again. Now, there is one more massive rule in this section, and it sounds almost like a spy thriller. The taping rule. What is this?
The taping rule targets firms that hire heavy concentrations of registered reps who previously worked at disciplined or expelled firms.
I don't understand. If a rep worked at a firm that got shut down by FINRA for fraud, why wouldn't FINRA just ban that rep entirely? Why let them get a new job?
Because the rep themselves might not have committed the fraud. The firm's management might have been corrupt, but the rep was just answering phones. However, if we look at the regulatory why behind this rule, it is built on the theory of contagion.
Contagion, like a virus.
Exactly like a virus. Regulators believe that a corrupt, high-pressure, unethical firm culture is infectious. When an expelled firm shuts down, its reps scatter into the wind. If Clara's firm suddenly hires a massive cluster of those infected reps, the regulators are terrified that the toxic culture will immediately take root and infect Clara's healthy firm.
Wow.
So if a firm hits a certain threshold of hiring these individuals, FINRA mandates a strict quarantine. The firm is forced to tape record all phone calls of all the registered persons for a full 3 years.
They have to tape everyone, not just the new hires. Okay, listener, if you're listening, grab your mental highlighter. Here are the exam traps for books and records. Trap number one, the six-year default fallback.
Right. This is where the exam tries to get you. If the SEC or FINRA does not state a specific, explicit retention period for a weird, obscure record, the default fallback is always 6 years. However, the SEC sets a specific floor for general communications, like emails and instant messages. That floor is 3 years.
So if Fred is trying to clean up his computer and he permanently purges all his client emails at the 2.5 year mark, he is in violation. And he cannot argue, well, the FINRA default is six, so I thought I had more time. No, he violated the 3 year communication floor.
Trap number two is about conflicting systems. Sometimes, multiple regulatory rules will apply to the exact same document, and they might mandate different retention periods. If that happens, the longer period always controls. You always default to keeping the paper for a longer time. And for any records related to a specific customer account, remember that the retention clock starts ticking at account closure, not when the piece of paper was originally made.
Trap number three is the math behind the taping rule. The thresholds depend entirely on how large your firm is. For a very small firm, let's say 5 to 9 registered reps, the trigger is 40%. If 40% of your staff comes from expelled firms, you have to tape.
But the exam loves to test the middle band, firms with 10 to 19 reps.
Right. The middle band does not use a percentage. It uses an absolute hard count of 4 reps. If Clara's firm has 15 total reps and she accidentally hires 3 reps from an expelled firm, she is fine. She's at 20%. But the moment she hires that 4th rep, boom, the absolute count is triggered and the tape recorders turn on.
You know, to make matters worse, if your firm is subject to the taping rule, That status is completely public on FineRaw BrokerCheck. It is a digital scarlet letter. Your clients will see it.
Can Clara fix it? Like, can she just fire someone the next day?
She gets one, and only one, 60-day window to adjust her staffing levels to get below the threshold to avoid the taping requirement. It's a one-time get-out-of-jail-free card. But she must drop below the threshold, not just tie it.
All right, so Clara has flawless records. We've got warm storage. We've executed the 643 double play. But let's be honest. All the pristine paperwork in the world won't save this firm if it runs out of money. This brings us to Section 3, Follow the Money. We are diving into financial responsibility.
This section is easily the most numeric, math-heavy unit on the Series 24 exam. It is entirely built on a system of overlapping floors and warning triggers. The entire philosophy is designed to ensure that if a broker-dealer goes bankrupt, it fails safely, and it doesn't drag its retail customers down into the abyss with it. The absolute bedrock of this is the net capital rule, or NC.
Break down net capital for me. Is it just a bank account balance?
Not exactly. Net capital is a strict liquid asset minimum. It is the floor for a safe wind down. The regulators look at your assets, subtract your liabilities, and then aggressively subtract anything that isn't highly liquid. And the minimum dollar amount you have to hold varies widely based on the exact nature of your firm's business.
Give me the breakdown.
At the top of the food chain, you have carrying or clearing firms. These are the massive institutions that actually hold customer funds and physical securities in their vaults. Their minimum net capital requirement is $250,000. A prime broker needs a whopping $1.5 million. A market maker generally needs $100,000, though it scales based on the number of stocks they make a market in.
What about our hypothetical firm? Let's say Clara, Dave, and Fred run a purely introducing firm. We don't hold the assets, we just introduce clients to a bigger clearing firm.
If you are an introducing firm that routinely receives customer funds, like checks made out to the clearing firm that pass through your office, your minimum is $50,000. If you're an introducing firm that never ever receives customer funds or securities, your minimum drops all the way down to a mere $5,000.
Okay, let's bring Desperate Dave into this. Dave is running the books for a month, and the firm is struggling. The regulators show up for a surprise audit of his net capital requirement. Dave is sweating bullets. He needs to hit that minimum. So he walks the auditor around the office. He points to his incredibly expensive custom-built mahogany desk. He proudly points out that he just prepaid the office rent for the next 12 months. He even tries to put a $500,000 value on the firm's brand, goodwill, and reputation.
And the regulator will look at him, take out a red pen, and ruthlessly subtract every single penny of those items from his net capital calculation.
Why? I mean, they have value, don't they?
Because they are what the SEC calls non-allowable assets. Remember the philosophy safe wind down. If Dave's firm collapses on a Tuesday, he cannot quickly liquidate a mahogany desk to generate cash to pay back a distressed customer. He certainly can't liquidate brand goodwill. Net capital is strictly about hard, fast liquidity.
So what does count? Stocks.
Stocks count. But even then, the regulators don't trust the market. If Dave holds $100,000 of blue chip stock as part of his capital, the regulators will apply what's called a haircut.
A haircut. They trim the value.
Exactly. A haircut is a mandatory percentage discount on the market value of the security. For a standard stock, it's typically a 15% haircut. So that $100,000 stock position is only counted as $85,000 for net capital purposes. The regulators are pricing in the risk that the stock market might crash in the exact moment Dave needs to sell the stock to survive.
That is incredibly conservative, but it makes sense. Okay, direct question for you, listener. Let's say Dave's introducing firm operates under that absolute lowest tier. He usually never touches customer funds, so his net capital minimum is just $5,000. But one rainy Tuesday, an elderly client walks into the office, gets confused, and hands Dave a personal check made out directly to Dave's firm to deposit into their account. What happens to Dave's minimum net capital requirement in that split second? Take a guess.
Think about the classifications.
It instantly shoots up to $50,000. Touching customer funds even once, even completely accidentally, alters your regulatory classification immediately.
It changes the entire game. Now, because this is so critical, the regulators have built an early warning ladder. Let's do a direct side-by-side comparison of hitting an early warning trigger versus actually falling below your minimum.
Let's do it. What happens if Dave's net capital actually drops below that $50,000 minimum?
That is a live, critical violation. The firm is technically insolvent under the rules. Dave must cease conducting all securities business immediately, and he must notify the SEC and fine RA on the exact same day.
Below minimum equals same day notice and you shut the doors. But the regulators don't want to be surprised by that, right?
Right. They don't want to wait until you are already financially dead to find out you were sick. So they set early warning triggers. If your net capital falls to 120% of your required minimum, you haven't technically violated the minimum yet. You are still breathing. But you are uncomfortably close to the edge. At 120%, you must give the regulators a 24-hour notice.
Okay, so below minimum is same day. 120% is 24 hours.
Got it. Let's shift gears slightly to another type of money margin.
Mm-hmm.
I want to compare Regulation T versus Fin-on Array margin because people always mix these up.
They do. Regulation T, or Reg T, is controlled by the Federal Reserve Board. It dictates the initial margin requirement, meaning when a customer first decides to buy a stock on margin, how much cash do they have to deposit into the account that very first day? Currently, Reg T is set at 50%.
So if Fred's client wants to buy $10,000 worth of Tesla stock on margin, they have to put up $5,000 in actual cash initially. The broker-dealer loans them the other $5,000. Precisely. Reg T is the Fed's tool to control leverage in the broader economy. But once the client actually owns that stock, Reg T steps back and fine-on-array age margin rules take over. Fine-on-array dictates the maintenance margin.
Maintenance margin. That's the amount you have to keep in the account as the stock price bounces around.
Yes. It's the minimum equity you must maintain to keep the lights on. The fine-on-array maintenance requirement is 25% of the current market value for long positions and 30% for short positions. If the client's equity drops below that line, they get a margin call and they have to deposit more cash immediately.
So Reg T is the entry fee at the door. Fine-on-array maintenance is the minimum drink tab you have to keep paying to stay in the club. Now, speaking of holding customer money, explain the customer protection rule. Why does a carrying firm have to separate their own firm cash from customer cash into a special reserve bank account?
This circles back to our core philosophy, protecting the retail investor from the firm's stupidity. Let's say the broker-dealer makes a series of catastrophic proprietary trades with its own money and goes completely bankrupt. The firm's creditors are going to show up with lawyers demanding every penny they can find to settle the debts.
And without this rule, they'd just seize the customer accounts too.
Exactly. The customer protection rule ensures that customer cash is legally locked away in a special reserve bank account. This account is completely segregated. The bank holding the account must agree in writing that the funds cannot be used to secure any loan or satisfy any lien against the broker-dealer. It creates an impenetrable vault, ensuring that retail investors don't lose their life savings just because Dave made a bad bet on pork bellies.
An impenetrable vault. I love that. But what happens if the vault is breached? What if the firm fails and somehow the money is just gone? That brings us to SITC, the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. And this is exactly where the exam tries to get you. Let's look at the traps.
Trap number one regarding SIPC is misunderstanding what it actually covers. SIPC covers the disappearance of customer assets due to the financial failure of the broker-dealer. It absolutely never covers market losses.
So if Dave recommends a terrible penny stock and it goes from $10 a share down to absolute zero, SIPC does not care. You made a bad investment. But if the firm goes bankrupt and the client's stock was literally stolen or is missing from the firm's vault, SIPC steps in to replace it.
Exactly. Trap number two is the math behind SIPC limits. The total coverage limit is $500,000 per separate customer capacity. But there is a massive, highly tested trick here involving the cash sublimit. The cash sublimit is $250,000.
Listener, let me repeat this because it's the most common mistake on this topic. The $250,000 cash sublimit is inside the $500K total. It is not on top of it.
That is the key. Let's walk through the math. If a customer has $300,000 in securities and $300,000 in cash in their account, they do not have $600,000 in coverage. They hit the $500,000 total maximum ceiling. The $300,000 in securities is fully covered, but because they hit the total cap, only $200,000 of their cash is covered.
Let's do another scenario. What if they have $100,000 in securities and $300,000 in cash?
In that case, the $100,000 in securities is fully covered, but their cash hits that strict $250,000 sublimit. So they get $100K for the stock, $250K for the cash, totaling $350,000 in coverage. That leaves $50,000 of their cash completely uncovered out in the cold.
And remember, that $500K limit is per capacity. If a client has an individual account, a joint account with their spouse, and an IRA, each of those three distinct capacities gets its own fresh $500,000 limit.
That's right, because the capacities are treated as distinct legal entities in the eyes of SIPC.
All right, so we have built the house, we've set our net capital floors, and SIPC is backing up the vaults. Now, what are our reps actually doing all day? What are they selling to make this money? Let's move to Section 4, the products we push, legally known as product and service supervision.
Before Dave or Fred can sell anything to a client, the firm itself must understand the product. A member firm must rigorously vet every new product and every material modification to an existing product through a documented new product review committee.
This isn't just a rubber stamp, is it?
Far from it. This committee must formally approve, disapprove, or table the product before a single rep is allowed to recommend it. And this process ties directly into the bedrock rule of suitability.
Let's break down suitability, because it's not just one thing, right? It's three separate prongs.
Correct. FANRI's suitability rule has three distinct prongs. The first is reasonable basis suitability. This means the firm has to understand the complexity and risks of the product and determine that it is suitable for at least some investors out there in the world. The documented record from that new product review committee is the firm's proof of reasonable basis suitability.
Okay, so prong one is this product legally viable for anyone? What's prong two?
Prong two is customer-specific suitability. This is the classic matching game. Does this specific product match the specific risk profile, age, and liquidity needs of the individual customer sitting across the desk?
And prong three?
Quantitative suitability. This prong dictates that even if a series of trades are individually suitable for the customer, the sheer volume or frequency of those trades cannot be excessive. If Fred is day trading a mutual fund in an elderly client's account, generating massive commissions while the account bleeds out from fees, he fails quantitative suitability.
Speaking of complex products, let's talk about a specific one that gets heavily tested. Variable contracts. Variable annuities and variable life insurance. Why are these treated with such intense regulatory scrutiny? I'm looking at a rule that requires a strict 7-business-day principal review for deferred variable annuities. Why so strict?
To understand the why, we have to look at history. Variable annuities have historically been ripe for abusive sales practices. They are incredibly complex, hybrid financial beasts. They are both a security, because the sub-accounts are invested directly in the stock market, and an insurance product, because they offer mortality guarantees and death benefits. Furthermore, they usually come packed with very high internal fees, massive surrender charges if the client tries to take their money out early, and enormous upfront commissions for the reps who sell them.
So the temptation for a rep to push these just for the massive commission payout is huge.
Exactly. Regulators know the conflict of interest is inherently high.
I have an analogy for this to help people remember. Variable contracts are the platypus of the financial world. You look at a platypus and you're confused. Is it a mammal? I mean, it has fur. But does it lay eggs like a duck? Yes, it does. It's weird. Variable contracts are exactly the same. Are they a security? Are they insurance? The answer is yes, they are both.
That is a perfect way to conceptualize it.
Yeah.
And because it is both, the compensation structure is strictly regulated. The commissions must flow only through the broker-dealer. The insurance carrier can never, ever pay the registered rep directly. It has to go through Clara's firm.
And that strict review rule.
Right. A registered principal like Careful Clara must personally review and approve or reject every single application for a deferred variable annuity no later than 7 business days after the OSJ receives a complete and correct application. And that approval has to happen before the application is transmitted to the insurance carrier.
Let's do a scenario to cement this timeline. Listener, direct question to you. Listen closely. Forgetful Fred takes an order from a client for a deferred variable annuity on a Monday. He fills out all the paperwork, but because he's Fred, he forgets to get the client's signature on page 3. He realizes his mistake, goes back to the client, gets the signature, and finally hands the completely flawless, correct application to Clara on Wednesday morning. When does Clara's 7-business-day clock to approve or reject it start ticking? Take a beat and think about it.
Pay attention to the wording there.
It starts on Wednesday. The 7-day clock explicitly begins when the OSJ receives the complete and correct package, not when the rep originally took the flawed order.
Exactly. The regulators are practical here. They don't want the principal's mandatory review clock running out while Fred is driving around town trying to track down a missing signature. The clock only starts when Clara has everything she needs to make an informed decision.
Okay, let's talk about corporate bonds for a second. I noticed there's an entire piece of legislation dedicated just to them, the Trust Indenture Act of 1939. What is this, and why do we care?
We care because it protects bondholders. During the Great Depression in the 1930s, a lot of massive corporations went bankrupt and defaulted on their bonds. The problem was that individual retail bondholders had no collective power. If you owned $1,000 of a railroad bond, you couldn't afford a lawyer to sue the massive railroad company for your money. You just lost it.
So Congress stepped in.
Yes. The Trust Indenture Act of 1939 requires that any non-exempt corporate bond issue over $50 million must be issued with a formal trust indenture. This is a legal contract that appoints an independent trustee, usually a large commercial bank, to act entirely on behalf of the bondholders. If the corporation defaults, that powerful trustee steps in, hires the lawyers, and fights the corporation to get the bondholders' money back.
So it's essentially a mandatory bodyguard for corporate bondholders. I love that. What about raising capital for smaller startups? I'm looking at Regulation A or Reg A Plus. People call these mini IPOs.
Reg A Plus is a brilliant mechanism. Doing a full S1 registration for a traditional IPO is incredibly expensive and time-consuming. It can cost millions of dollars just in legal fees. Mm-hmm. If a medium-sized startup wants to raise a smaller amount of capital from the public, they can use Reg A Plus. It offers two tiers.
Well, break down the tiers.
Tier 1 allows a company to raise up to $20 million in a 12-month period. It's relatively straightforward, but the downside is that the issuer still has to comply with individual state blue sky laws in every single state where they want to sell the shares.
Registering in 50 different states sounds like a nightmare. What's the alternative?
Tier 2. This allows a company to raise up to $75 million in a 12-month period. The massive advantage of Tier 2 is that it explicitly preempts state blue sky laws. You don't have to register state by state. However, in exchange for that freedom, Tier 2 requires the company to provide audited financial statements and file ongoing semi-annual reports with the SEC.
So Tier 1 is a lower dollar amount with state headaches. Tier 2 is a higher dollar amount, skips the state headaches, but requires you to act more like a public company with your accounting.
That's a great distinction.
Yeah.
All right, if you're taking the exam, get ready. Exam traps for the product section.
This is where the exam tries to get you. Trap number one involves mutual fund fees, specifically the 12B1 fee.
What exactly is a 12B1 fee? I know it's a drag on the fund, but how does it work mechanically? It is an ongoing operational expense. It is named directly after SEC Rule 12B1 under the Investment Company Act of 1940. This rule allows a mutual fund to deduct a small percentage directly out of the fund's net asset value, the NAV, every single year, to pay for marketing, distribution, and advertising costs. It is essentially an invisible load that the investor pays continuously.
So what's the trap?
The trap is the word no load. Finery rules dictate that a mutual fund absolutely cannot market itself as a no load fund if its 12B1 fee is above 0.25%, which is 25 basis points. Let's say a fund has zero front-end sales charge and zero back-end surrender charge. It looks free to enter and exit. But if that ongoing 12B1 marketing fee is 0.26%, slapping the no-load label on the brochure is illegal.
Even missing it by one basis point makes it a violation. That is heavily tested. Trap number two, breakpoint sales. This ties back to quantitative suitability.
It does. Mutual funds often offer volume discounts on front-end sales charges. These discount thresholds are called breakpoints. For example, let's say the sales charge drops from 5% down to 4% if the client invests $25,000 or more.
Enter Desperate Dave.
Right. Dave realizes that if the client hits that discount, Dave's own Kamoan payout goes down. So Dave deliberately recommends that the client invest $24,500. He intentionally keeps them just a few hundred dollars below the threshold to maximize his own commission percentage. That is a breakpoint sale violation. Dave is legally required to disclose the breakpoint and inform the client of their rights of accumulation.
Trap number three involves the Investment Company Act of 1940. This act classifies investment companies into three types: face amount certificate companies, management companies, which include your standard open-end mutual funds and closed-end funds, and unit investment trusts, or UITs.
The exam trap here is purely about the governance structure of a UIT. A unit investment trust has no board of directors. None.
How does it run without a board?
Because a UIT is not actively managed. It is a fixed, static portfolio of securities, usually bonds. They create the portfolio, lock it, and let it ride until maturity. Because there is no active trading, they don't need a board of directors or an investment advisor. The trust is simply administered by a trustee who handles the clerical work of distributing the interest payments.
While we are talking about the 1940 Act, I have to bring up the 75-5-10 test. This is the definition of a diversified management company. Walk me through the numbers.
The test is a formula. To call itself diversified, a fund must invest its assets in a very specific way. At least 75% of the fund's total assets must be invested such that no more than 5% of the total assets are concentrated in any single issuer, and the fund cannot own more than 10% of the outstanding voting stock of any single issuer.
Okay, I have a massive question about this. If the 5% and 10% restrictions only apply to that 75% bucket, what on earth happens to the remaining 25% of the fund's money?
That is the 25% wildcard bucket. And it is exactly what the regulators allow. The fund manager can take that entire remaining 25% and do absolutely whatever they want with it. They could dump all 25% into a single stock. They could buy 100% of a tiny company with it. The regulators do not care as long as the core 75% meets the diversification test.
Wow. So a diversified fund can still have a massive, heavily concentrated bet in its portfolio. That is wild and definitely testable. Okay. The products are approved, the suitability is documented, and the funds are diversified. Now, how do Dave and Fred actually get paid for doing this without breaking the law? Let's move to Section 5, Getting Paid, covering compensation practices.
Compensation practices dictate how, when, and to whom a firm may pay money or non-cash items. Let's start with the most fundamental prohibition. Who can you not pay? No member firm or associated person may pay transaction-based compensation to anyone who is not formally registered as a broker-dealer.
Transaction-based compensation, meaning a commission tied to a trade.
Exactly. But wait, you might ask, what about bank branches? We see broker-dealers operating out of retail bank lobbies all the time.
Right. I walk into my bank, and there's a guy at a desk in the corner selling mutual funds. How does that work?
Those are called networking arrangements. It is a formal, written agreement where a broker-dealer offers services at a financial institution. Crucially, the broker-dealer is the entity doing the securities business, not the bank itself. The bank is just a landlord.
But what if a regular unregistered bank teller sees I have a lot of cash in my checking account and refers me over to the broker in the corner? Can the broker pay the teller for that lead?
Yes, but under incredibly strict conditions. The firm can pay that unregistered bank employee only a one-time nominal cash referral fee. It must be a flat, small fee like $25 or $50. Most importantly, that fee cannot be contingent on the customer actually opening an account or executing a trade. The teller gets the 25 bucks just for making the introduction, regardless of the outcome.
Disclosures must be huge in these bank setups, right? Because a customer could easily think they are buying a safe FDIC-insured CD when they are actually buying a risky mutual fund.
Yes, the not-not-may disclosures. The client must be informed that the investments are not FDIC-insured, not bank-guaranteed, and may lose value. Written disclosures of this are always required in a networking arrangement.
But oral disclosure has a weird trigger.
It does. Oral disclosure is triggered by where the account is physically opened. If the account is opened by a client sitting physically on the bank's premises, oral disclosure by the rep is mandatory.
All right, I want to talk about the clerical carve-out. Because a broker-dealer isn't just brokers. Clara's firm has an HR department, IT staff, and back office administrative assistants. None of them are registered. Can they get paid bonuses?
The rule here is a strict dividing line. An unregistered clerical employee can absolutely take a standard salary, and they can even receive a discretionary year-end bonus based on the firm's overall profitability. But they can never receive transaction-based compensation.
What if the phones are ringing off the hook, Dave is in the bathroom, and the unregistered IT guy picks up the phone? A client screams, "Buy 100 shares of Apple at the market." Can the IT guy take the order?
Absolutely not. Accepting a customer order is never considered a clerical function. It crosses the line into registered activity. If the IT guy takes that order, he is acting as an unregistered broker, and the firm is in massive trouble.
Okay, let's bring Dave back into the mix. Dave is trying to win over a massive whale of a client. He wants to shower this client with gifts to earn their business. But FINRA has a strict gift limit. It recently increased, right? It used to be $100, now it's $300.
Correct. The limit is now $300 per person per year.
Dave thinks he's found a brilliant loophole. He doesn't send one big gift. He spaces it out. In the spring, he sends the client a beautiful $100 fruit basket. In the summer, he sends a $150 bottle of wine. And for the holidays in December, he sends an $80 glazed ham. Dave proudly points out to Clara that no single gift was over the $300 limit.
and Clara intercepts the ham before it reaches the mailroom. Why? Because gifts are aggregated. They are aggregated per recipient, per calendar year, across the entire firm and all its reps. So Clara does the math. Dave's gifts total 100 plus 150 plus 80. That's $330. He has breached the $300 annual cap. That is a clear violation.
Let's do a direct comparison here because this is where the exam gets tricky.
Yeah.
What if, instead of the ham, Dave buys two tickets to see the Broadway show Hamilton? The tickets are $200 each. If Dave just puts the tickets in an envelope, mails them to the client, and stays home on his couch, that's a $400 gift, right? Violation.
Correct. Mailing the tickets makes it a gift subject to the dollar cap. But TP, if Dave attends the show with the client, it completely changes regulatory category.
It's no longer a gift.
No. It becomes business entertainment. Entertainment is not subject to the strict $300 value cap. Federer recognizes that taking a client out to a nice dinner or a show is a normal part of building relationships. The only rule for entertainment is that it must not be so frequent or lavish that it raises a question of propriety.
So attendance is the magic differentiating factor. If you go with them, it's entertainment. If you send it and stay home, it's a gift. That is a massive distinction. Now, what about non-cash compensation inside the firm, like sales contests? Can Clara's firm run a contest to motivate Dave and Fred?
Internal sales contests are allowed, but there is a major why behind the restrictions placed on them. They are permitted only if they are based on the total production of all securities of all offerors, and the contest must credit all products of a specific type equally.
Why equally? Why can't the firm incentivize what they want to sell?
Because regulators are terrified of secret incentives creating toxic conflicts of interest. Let's say Clara's firm has its own in-house proprietary mutual fund. But the fund is terrible. It has high fees and poor performance. If the firm runs a contest where selling the in-house fund gets you triple points toward winning a trip to Hawaii, Dave's going to stop recommending good outside funds and shove every client into the terrible in-house fund just to win the vacation.
Equal weighting prevents the firm from secretly bribing its own reps to push toxic products. That makes perfect sense. Exam traps for compensation.
This is where the exam tries to get you. Trap number one is the retiring rep exception. We just established that you generally cannot pay transaction-based commissions to unregistered persons.
Yeah.
But there is a specific continuing commission exception for retiring reps.
How does that work?
A rep who is retiring from the industry can continue to receive trail commissions on their old, existing book of business even after they drop their FINRA registration.
But what is the trap?
The trap is the timing of the paperwork. The bona fide written contract establishing this arrangement must be signed while the rep is still actively registered. You cannot retire in January, realize you are running out of money in July, and then call your old firm asking them to draft a continuing commission contract. Once you drop that license, the door is locked. And furthermore, the retiree absolutely cannot service those accounts or solicit new business after they leave.
Okay, so we know what reps should do to get paid. Let's look at what happens when Dave and Fred decide the rules simply don't apply to them and they start getting creative. Welcome to Section 6, Bad Behavior, formerly known as the Conduct of Associated Persons.
This unit is the conduct rulebook. The ultimate catch-all rule is the requirement to observe high standards of commercial honor and just and equitable principles of trade. FINRA can stack this charge on top of any other specific violation, or they can use it entirely as a standalone charge if you do something unethical that doesn't explicitly violate a separate rule.
Then you have the Federal General Anti-Fraud Rule, Rule 10b-5. This hinges heavily on the concept of materiality.
Right. Omitting a material fact is fraud. And materiality has a specific legal definition. Would a reasonable investor find this piece of information important when making a decision to buy or sell? If yes, it's material.
Let's do a quick pattern interrupt. I want to talk about the really bad behavior again. I want to talk about prison. Remember our hook at the beginning.
The Exchange Act criminal ladder. Think of the numbers 5, 20, 25.
5, 20, 25. What do they mean? $5 million is the maximum individual criminal fine. 20 years is the maximum individual federal prison sentence. And $25 million is the maximum criminal fine for an entity like the broker-dealer itself. The stakes are massive.
They are. Now let's talk about the misuse of customer assets, because this is incredibly common in real-world disciplinary actions.
Let's bring in Forgetful Fred. Fred is a nice guy, but he is a little short on his personal apartment rent this month. He has a great relationship with a wealthy client. On a Monday, he just quickly borrows $5,000 from the customer's account to cover his rent. but Fred genuinely means well. On Friday, he gets his paycheck, and he returns the $5,000 to the client's account perfectly intact, and he even adds a little interest out of his own pocket to say thanks. He thinks no harm, no foul. Direct question to you, listener. Does Fred's genuine intent to repay the money matter to Fenera?
The answer is no.
Absolutely not. Borrowing from a customer without falling under one of the specific firm-approved written exceptions, like if the customer is an immediate family member, is an improper use of assets. It is effectively theft in the eyes of the regulator. His intent to repay on Friday is completely 100% irrelevant.
Precisely. Fenra does not care about your heart. They care about the rules. Let's look at another example with Desperate Dave. Dave really wants a nervous client to invest in a highly speculative tech stock. The client is hesitating. So Dave says, look, buy the stock. I believe in it so much that if it goes down, I will personally cover any losses out of my own pocket. The client buys it, the stock skyrockets, and no loss ever occurs.
Did Dave violate a rule? No one lost money.
Yes, he did. The verbal promise itself is a prohibited guarantee against loss. It fundamentally doesn't matter if the loss never actually materializes. Only the firm can reimburse a loss after the fact due to a legitimate trading error. A rep can never guarantee against market risk beforehand.
Let's do a side-by-side comparison of two major acronyms that look similar but operate very differently, OBA and PST.
OBA stands for outside business activity. This is any outside employment or compensated activity that a rep engages in. If Fred decides he needs extra cash and drives for Uber on the weekends, or Dave owns an apartment building that pays him rental income, those are OBAs. They require prior written notice to the firm. Clara needs to know about them to check for conflicts of interest.
And PST stands for private securities transaction.
Exactly. A PST is a securities transaction executed outside the regular scope of the rep's employment. This is colloquially known as selling away. Like an OBA, it requires prior written notice. Fatidi, here is the critical, heavily tested difference. If the rep is receiving selling compensation for that private securities transaction, the firm must formally approve or disapprove it in writing.
And if they approve it?
If Clara approves Dave receiving a finder's fee for selling a private placement to his golf buddy on the weekend, the firm must record that transaction on its own official books and supervise it exactly as if it were the firm's own trade.
That is a massive burden on careful Clara. If Dave sells a private deal on the side, Clara has to supervise it as if her firm underwrote the whole thing. No wonder most firms simply deny PSTs with compensation outright.
It's too much risk. Another side-by-side comparison you must keep straight involves information barriers, specifically when a firm has both investment banking and retail operations. They must have written policies to prevent the misuse of material non-public information, or MNPI.
The watch list versus the restricted list.
A watch list is highly internal. It is known only to Clara and the compliance department. It is pre-public.
Yeah.
Let's say Clara monitors trading in a specific healthcare stock because the firm's banking division is secretly working on a merger deal for them. Clara doesn't tell Dave or Fred. She just quietly watches their trades.
But once the deal is announced,
then it moves to the restricted list. This list is firm-wide and post-public. Clara sends a memo to the entire firm, including Dave and Fred, and says, stop trading the stock immediately. No soliciting, no proprietary trading.
Let's dive deep into insider trading, because the legal definition of this has actually evolved over the decades, hasn't it?
It has, and it's fascinating. Originally, the SEC relied on the classical theory. Under this theory, an insider like the CEO of a company breaches a fiduciary duty to their own shareholders by trading on secret information.
But what if you aren't an insider? What if you are just a lawyer working on the deal?
That gap led the courts to develop the misappropriation theory. This says you don't have to be connected to the company whose stock you are trading at all. If you steal secret information from your employer, like a junior lawyer at a law firm working on a confidential merger, and you trade on it, you have breached a duty of trust and confidence to the source of the information. You misappropriated their secret for personal gain. That is insider trading.
And what about the SEC's standard for actually executing the trade? Do they have to prove that the secret information is what convinced you to push the buy button?
They used to. The SEC used to have to prove that the secret information actually motivated your decision to trade. But brilliant defense lawyers would argue, my client was going to buy the stock anyway. The secret information didn't motivate them. It was incredibly hard to prove motivation. So the SEC changed the rule.
To what?
Now, insider trading occurs if you trade on the basis of MNPI, which the SEC defines simply as being aware of the information when you made the trade. Motivation does not matter anymore. If the secret was in your brain and you made the trade, you are guilty.
Is there any defense against that?
The only affirmative defense is proving you had a prearranged written trading plan, often called a 10b5-1 plan, that was adopted before you became aware of the information and you didn't alter it or deviate from it.
Okay, exam traps for conduct.
This is where the exam tries to get you. Trap number one, sharing in customer accounts. A rep actually can share in the profits and losses of a customer's account, but it requires three strict things. First, prior written firm approval. Second, prior written customer approval. Third, the rep sharing must be strictly proportionate to their actual financial contribution to the account. If you put in 10% of the money, you can only take 10% of the profits.
But here's the trick the exam will use. If the customer is an immediate family member, the proportionality requirement is entirely waived. You can contribute 10% of the money and take 50% of the profits if your mom agrees to it. But listen closely. Immediate family status never waives the requirement for prior written firm approval. Clara still has to say yes before you open that joint account with your mom.
Track number two, the 10-day corporate action notice. If a publicly traded company is declaring a dividend or executing a stock split, they have to formally notify FINRA. The trap is the timeline. The notice must be given to FINRA at least 10 days before the record date, not the ex-dividend date. The record date is the anchor point for the regulatory filing.
Okay, so Dave guaranteed a loss, Fred borrowed money from a client's account to pay his rent, and careful Clara finally caught them both. The regulators have been called, the clients are furious, here comes the fallout.
Which brings us to Section 7, the fallout. Disciplinary actions and customer disputes. When things go wrong, there is a very specific, highly tested flow of paperwork and adjudication. Let's start with the paperwork.
If a customer submits a written complaint, say, accusing Dave of theft, what does Clara do?
First, the firm must keep a record of that written complaint at the OSJ for at least 4 years. Remember that 4-year retention period from our 643 double play earlier? That is where this applies.
And Clara can't just throw in a filing cabinet and hope it goes away. She has active reporting duties.
She does. Depending on the severity of the event, she might have to file a specific per-event report to FINRA. This is due within 30 days of the firm discovering the event. And regardless of whether it triggers a 30-day report, almost all complaints must be rolled up into a quarterly statistical report due by the 15th of the month following the end of the calendar quarter.
Let's do a scenario with Dave. A client is absolutely furious about a bad trade and sends an email accusing Dave of outright theft. The client demands $100,000 in restitution. Dave panics. He doesn't want FINRA involved. He doesn't want to lose his license. So he negotiates privately with the client. He manages to settle the dispute for $16,000 out of his own pocket. The client signs a non-disclosure agreement, drops the complaint, and Dave goes to Clara and asks her to just keep it quiet. Direct question, listener. Does Clara still have to report Dave's settlement to FINRA, even though the client signed an NDA and dropped it?
What do you think?
Yes, she absolutely has to report it. Here's the mechanic. The threshold for reporting a private settlement by a registered person is if the final settled amount is over $15,000. If the firm itself settles the dispute, the threshold jumps to over $25,000. It fundamentally does not matter that the original demand was $100,000. The reporting trigger is based on the final settled amount. Dave settled for $16,000, which is over $15,000. It must be reported.
And we have to look at the nature of the original complaint. Because the initial email involved an allegation of theft, Clara actually has to do two things. She has 30 days to file a specific per event report about the theft allegation itself, PLUS. She has to include the $16,000 settlement in the quarterly statistical roll-up. FINRA wants to know about both the accusation of severe misconduct and the monetary payout.
Okay, now let's talk about where these disputes actually get resolved if they don't settle privately. This is a classic exam trap, so let's do a direct side-by-side comparison of the three different codes FINRA uses. We have the Code of Procedure, the Code of Arbitration, and the Code of Mediation. They all sound like courtroom dramas, but they do very different things.
The test loves to mix these up. Let's start with the Code of Procedure. This is FINRA's internal disciplinary court. This is FINRA acting as the police and prosecuting you for breaking their rules. The Department of Enforcement brings the formal charges, a hearing panel tries the case, and if you appeal, it goes to the National Adjudicatory Council, or NAC. This code is entirely about fines, suspensions, and industry bars.
So procedure equals FINRA disciplining you.
Got it. Right. The Code of Arbitration, on the other hand, is for resolving private disputes, usually about money. A customer suing Dave for bad advice, or Clara's firm suing a former rep who quit without paying back a signing bonus. Arbitration is a binding resolution. An arbitration panel hears the case, issues a monetary award, and that award is final and enforceable in a regular civil court.
I have a question about arbitration. Why can a retail customer unilaterally compel a broker-dealer to go to arbitration, but a broker-dealer cannot compel a customer to go unless there is a pre-dispute arbitration agreement signed beforehand?
This is a deliberate regulatory power dynamic designed to protect the retail investor. Wall Street firms have endless financial resources and armies of corporate lawyers. If a firm could drag a small retail investor into a drawn-out multi-year court battle, the investor would go bankrupt just paying legal fees before they ever saw a judge. Arbitration is significantly faster and cheaper. So the rules dictate that a customer can always demand arbitration to get a quick resolution. But the firm cannot force the customer into it unless the customer previously agreed in writing when they opened the account.
That makes total sense. Protect the little guy. And the third code is the code of mediation.
Mediation is entirely voluntary and non-binding. A neutral mediator tries to help the two sides negotiate and reach a settlement, but the mediator has absolutely no power to decide the case or force a resolution. It's just facilitated negotiation.
Okay, exam traps for the fallout.
This is where the exam tries to get you. Trap number one, mediation timelines. Let's say two parties are locked in a bitter arbitration battle. They decide to try mediation on the side to see if they can settle and save legal fees. The exam will ask you if the mediation pauses the arbitration. The answer is no. Mediation does not stay or pause the pending arbitration deadlines unless both parties expressly agree in writing to pause it. Otherwise, those arbitration clocks keep ticking relentlessly.
Trap number two concerns expungement. What is CRD?
CRD stands for the Central Registration Depository. Think of it as the permanent, unerasable digital report card for anyone working in the securities industry. Every complaint, every settlement, every regulatory action lives on your CRD record, and much of it feeds into the public broker check system.
So let's say Dave actually wins his arbitration case. The panel looks at the evidence and says Dave did absolutely nothing wrong. The client was lying. Dave understandably wants this bogus complaint deleted from his public CRD record. The exam will try to trick you into thinking FINRA just deletes it automatically because he won. They don't. Expungement is incredibly hard to get.
How hard? An arbitration panel must make an affirmative, documented finding that the claim was factually impossible, that the rep was completely uninvolved in the transaction, or that the claim was entirely false. Just winning the case on a legal technicality or settling below the reporting threshold isn't enough. Indeed, even if the arbitration panel grants the expungement request, Dave still has to take that arbitration award to a real-world civil court of competent jurisdiction to get it formally confirmed by a judge before FINRA will actually scrub the record.
It is a massive uphill battle. Trap number three, ignoring FINRA. Let's say FINRA sends Fred a formal written request for information about a trade. Fred looks at the trade and knows he is 100% innocent. The trade was flawless. But because he's Fred and he's disorganized, he just throws the letter in a drawer and ignores FINRA's requests.
Failure to respond to a FINRA request for information is its own standalone severe violation. If you ignore them for 90 days, it triggers an automatic bar from the industry. You will be permanently kicked out of the securities business, even if you were completely, totally innocent of the original matter they were investigating. Never, ever ignore a letter from FINRA.
Never ignore Clara and never ignore FINRA. Okay, we have built the house, we funded it with net capital, we sold products, we paid the reps, we watched them break the rules, and we watched them face arbitration. It is time for our outro. We're going to do a high-energy, rapid-fire volley of the absolute most testable numbers and concepts we covered today. You ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Record retention ladder.
The 6-4-3 double play. 6 years for foundational customer info, 4 years for written complaints, 3 years for authorizations and communications.
Exchange Act criminal penalties.
5-20-25. 5 million maximum individual fine, 20 years maximum prison, 25 million entity fine.
Net capital minimum for a carrying firm.
250,000.
The gift cap.
$300 per person per year, aggregated firm-wide. Unless you attend the event, then it's entertainment.
Deferred variable annuity principal review.
7 business days from receipt of a complete and correct package.
Excellent. That is the core of the Series 24.
Before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final philosophical thought to mull over as you continue studying. Think about how these foundational rules were largely written in the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 and the Investment Company Act of 1940. We are actively applying legal definitions designed for paper stock certificates, physical ledger books, and telegrams to a modern world of fractional shares traded on iPhones via cloud computing algorithms. As you take this exam, notice the tension between 20th century analog rules and 21st century digital realities. That tension, that awkward translation between eras, is exactly where the hardest, most nuanced questions on this exam lie.
That is such a profound way to look at it. The regulatory muddy waters we talked about at the very beginning. That mud is just the friction between 1934 and today. But you have the map now. You understand the why behind the written supervisory procedures, the net capital haircuts, the product suitability, and the disciplinary fallout. You know how Dave, Fred, and Clara operate, which makes you untrickable on test day? Keep diving into the material, trust the process, and go crush this exam. Good luck out there.